Hi Calvin, here we are again.
Hi, Ore.
We were just talking about this question which I popped for you of can you tell some more about the tetrion universe, starting with tetrions, fermions, bosons, tetrionic atoms, tetrionic materials, organic and inorganic, and then you say, well, let's start the other way around. Let's start from the basics of the fermions and the bosons. Because
Right.
once you understand that bosons are actually expansions in one direction and photons are expansions in two directions, then you can also understand that electromagnetic fields are expansions in three directions, and then you can start to understand it. At which point I asked, well, maybe it would be helpful to have a bit of a further explanation of how these different directions all connect up. And in an hour, you have unfolded how you came to see that, but also how, as a result, you came to understand everything in a different manner. You told us that there is this difference between energy, mass, and matter. But if you do not understand that, if you do not understand that those are actually different dimensions in which displacement and time are connected in different ways, then you cannot understand other stuff as well. And an example which you gave was the incomplete Einstein equation E equals mc squared, for which you said there is also the divided by c squared part of it, which needs to be understood.
Yes, E divided by E equals E. Oh, yeah. Yes, correct. I'll leave it at that.
So,
They've got a
basically,
whole lot of
that you
discussion there.
immediately pointed out to say a symmetry, anti-symmetry, which needs to be accounted for in the equations, and it does require this four-dimensional understanding, where c to the fourth is an actual measure of a space sphere, and that as a result of that, then you can start to understand how everything falls in place. Which basically brings me back to the starting question. With that in mind, then how for you did you see that on those basic principles the whole universe is sort of built up?
I must admit the easiest part for me when I first started this, as I developed the quantum mechanical understanding, was simply printing out the triangles, numbering them, or eventually lettering them, and seeing what they built, what shapes, what geometries, what worked, what didn't, how they should interact, and then developing a more comprehensive model of what it was I'd actually built on the desktop. As I said, for a long time, I had mixed up photons with tetrions because tetrions don't exist in modern science. These tetrions that I built had to have a role, and I could see that they were the quantum of matter. And from that, as I developed the work, I also had to apply it to known physics, known observations, and try and make sense of it and expand upon what we had. And as we just touched on the previous one, the biggest things that had to be understood was the role of charge, as in Planck quanta come with a positive and a negative charged face, and how these quanta interact via these charges, electric and magnetic interactions, to form different things, all the particles and fields of the standard model. And then the hard work really began, because as I had built the models and I knew what the models were telling me, I then had to reconcile it with what was printed in popular literature, what the textbooks were saying, what the mathematics were saying, and try and rewrite, or firstly reassign the properties of particles and fields to these geometries, and do it in a way that the information was concise, the results were correct, and it could be used as a basis of re-educating or relearning what we've been taught about these particles being little balls of energy or chunks of mass or matter without any real understanding. So I got into it. We touched on in the previous discussion the empty space versus space with energy that creates our universe and its forces. And the first step was to obviously look at what are bosons and what are fermions, what are fields and what are particles. Physics has a nasty habit of every time somebody discovers some interesting aspect, they give it a new name. And it doesn't matter if it's actually the same as another particle, which is viewed from a different direction or a different set of properties, a new name it gets. So I had to wade through all these names, had to sort out what was what in the form of physical geometries and topologies, and apply this to what we've previously discussed with spatial measurements in order to rationalize the physics that's out there at the moment. Obviously, from the previous discussion, we now have a good understanding of what is meant when Newton says energy per second versus Einstein's formulation of mass is energy per c squared. We know that they're interrelatable because of the fixed velocity of light over in a certain period of time in concert with the geometry of the energy itself. Its particular geometry will only allow propagation in certain directions. The first one of these are the bosons. They're just what we would call Planck's constant, what you would call an equilateral triangle of energy momenta. The momenta is obviously the height or the square root of the equilateral triangle itself, and it gives it a compass point, if you like, a direction that it's going to head in. You release that energy and it will go in the direction of its linear momentum. The bosons are the Planck quanta. They are the fundamental building block of everything in our universe. Take them away, you remove the energy and its associated momenta, and you end up with empty space. Nothing happening, nothing left behind. Everything from Planck's constant itself up to our consciousness is made up of these little triangles of energy. So they are the most fundamental building blocks, and they are the bosons. Bosons are defined as two-dimensional charged fields of electromagnetic radiation. A single triangle, the Planck quanta, has a north and a south field, which is equal in strength to its electric field. Flip it over, and the exact opposite charge is seen on the other side of it. So these one triangle can be positive or negative. One of the earliest definitions I had to work through was exactly what it is, what geometries are bosons. We know they're fields. We know particularly that they are charge carriers. You have positive and negative W bosons, as they're termed, and another one, W neutral or W zero, which was brought about because, again, scientists, having worked out that there was positive and negative, felt that there should be a neutral. From some aspects, you could call a photon a W neutral boson or W naught, I think they're pronounced. They are a plus and a minus boson, two triangles coming together, they become neutral. It actually turns out that there is a distinct W naught boson geometry, which is two triangles coming together side by side instead of end to end. So instead of a diamond shape, you have a trapezoidal shape, a rhombus, just like a squash, like a diamond on its side. It's exactly the same in all respects to a photon, except it propagates sideways. Again, you'll see that when you see the triangles you make, or if you look at my illustrations, you'll see that it has different direction of propagation compared to a traditional photon. But apart from that, it's indistinguishable. The bosons themselves are designated or highlighted or defined in tetrionics as odd number geometries. That is to say, when you form a W boson, it will have 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, 1,555 triangles of alternating positive and negative charges side by side. Because they have odd number quanta of positive and negatives, they'll always end up with all the pluses and minuses will cancel out except for one, and you'll either have a net positive or a net negative charge, hence W bosons. So they're the primordial field, if you like, the quanta of matter. The lowest you can get is one, odd number, it's Planck's constant, or Planck quanta. Again, the opposite side, you could flip it, and it'll just reverse the charges. So the underside of a W minus is actually W plus, and vice versa. The underside of a positive charge is a negative charge. That's how the geometry shows us how it works. Flipping something over like that is just a Lorentz coordinate transfer. It's the same as looking at it from the other side of the coin. But these odd numbers are what make up squared, or as I prefer to call them, equilateral energy fields. They're squared numbers. They're the squared numbers in physics that everyone talks about. But these equilateral energy fields are always made up through the summation or addition of sequential odd numbers. We've touched on this before. 1 and 3 makes 4, a squared number. 1 and 3 and 5 gives you 9, again, a squared number. And on it goes. There's a specific sequence in adding or removing odd-numbered bosons, field geometries, to squared scalar energies. And by scalar, I just mean a large equilateral surface area. You can also have, as we've just touched on before, even numbers as well as odd numbers. Again, this harks back to basic mathematics. The even numbers of bosons coming together, or of Planck quanta is probably a better term, even number Planck quanta coming together will form diamonds, photons. Now, you can have neutral photons, which most people are familiar with, plus and minus, in which case the bosons will travel in opposite directions, causing light to spread out bilaterally from its source. Again, it's a field. It has energy per second, or energy per c squared, so it has mass. And you can have neutral photons as well as charged photons, which make electrostatic fields. We'll talk about fields in a second. So, in essence, odd and even Planck quanta can immediately be associated with mass and electromagnetic fields. So if somebody says there's an electromagnetic field, you know that it's a field of mass and it has plus and minus, made up of plus and minus triangles of energy. That's the simplest way to describe it. These fields are flat, just like a sheet of paper, and they'll point out whichever direction that linear momentum points. In a case where you develop a electromagnetic field around, say, a sphere, like you do in the Van de Graaff generators, or any shape for that matter, the equilateral triangles will point outward from the sphere in all the directions that they can, always being in pairs, a plus going one direction, a minus going the other. Well, in the case of an electrostatic charge, it'll be all plus fields, all pointing out. For example, for a positive charge field. If it was a negative charge field, they'd be all negative triangles pointing outwards to create a negative charge field. They take up a 3D volume. Because they're triangles on their side, they have X, Y, and Z components, because they form this sphere of triangles. What people sense and draw as circles around a charged object or lines, the circles around them are actually full of spokes of triangles, as if you're viewing the triangles from their side, looking down on them. And sometimes you'll see them drawn with, if it's a positive field, with arrows pointing outwards. Those outward pointing arrows will be positive linear momentum pointing outwards. Now, in the case of a negative field, the linear momentum would still be pointing outwards, but it would have a different effect. It's a negative charge compared to a positive, so it produces a different result to what the positive does on charged particles within those fields. I won't labour the point, but if you hear the word mass or fields or bosons or photons, you immediately think flat pieces of triangular paper of mass energy. There is no matter component. They are just like little sheets of paper, a bit like the Christmas decorations some of you may have gotten over the years when you're growing up, where you get a shape, you unclip it, fold it back on itself, and you have this little ball with all these little veins popping out in all directions to form a ball or a Christmas bell. Similar situation to that is how fields are made up of mass energy. And it's important because you don't have massless particles, as we discussed in the previous discussion. So as soon as you have energy, you have mass. Mass is strictly, the best way to think of it is just a sheet of paper. Equilateral triangles of paper pointing out or coming together in different ways. Just as you can add odd numbers together to make larger, scalar, equilateral fields of energy, you can also add even numbers together. 2, 4, 6, 8. All these diamonds are photons. They add together and they form electromagnetic fields. So if somebody talks about a charge surface, odd number of mass energies of Planck quanta. If they talk about a electromagnetic field or electromagnetic wave, even better, in the case of a wave, it is simply even numbers. You will always have an even number of quanta in the field to make up that field. It'll never be an odd number. It'll always be an even number, and it'll always have a diamond shape. The reason why we draw them as circles is because we measure where their force is, how strong and how weak it is. And that's a property of the geometry of the triangles themselves, or the diamonds. And we measure them at different points and just measure the values. The geometry determines all that. Where you see the circle, it's actually a diamond tipped on its side. Now, we've covered fields, photons, bosons. The next thing you can do, and these are all planar things, they're just like sheets of paper traveling through the air. The next thing that you can create is a particle. And now that we've done bosons, the particles are called fermions, after Enrico Fermi. The best description of them is that they are a form of energy that has a volume, and no two particles can exist in the same space or region of space at the same time. That is to say, like 2 billiard balls, they can come close and they can touch, but you can't make the 2 billiard balls exist in the same space at the same time. So there's a characteristic about them which is obviously made up from mass and energy, that sets it apart from light, from bosons and from photons. And that property is its topology. Whereas mass energy had geometries, equilateral geometries, planar geometries, matter or fermions have a topology. And by that I mean the equilateral geometries come together in such a way as to make a volume. They displace a region of space. They have a Z component to them. And that is what gives them the tangibility of the desk. It's not the repulsion of the electrons as currently stated in a lot of QM theories. The tetrahedral shape of four masses coming together, interacting via their charge, forms a tetrion, which is just another name for a tetrahedral standing wave. Now, the mass energy in that tetrahedral shape still moves at the speed of light, just like it does for a photon spreading outwards. But because of the tetrahedral shape, it moves in that shape constantly. The energy spreads out in that tetrahedral shape and it circulates. That's why I call it a standing wave. The energies are still moving all the time at the speed of light in that tetrahedral shape, but the shape, the topology itself is standing still. It's a standing wave topology. Now, once you create that, you can't put two tetrahedrons inside the same space. They can come close to each other and touch, and if they do, depending on their positive and negative charges of their mass geometries, they will either attract or repel. If they attract, they can form larger and larger compounds, or atoms first, then compounds and molecules, and we go on to chemistry, stars and planets. But the fermions themselves are simply anything that has three dimensions and has mass energy. They're stationary. They don't move until we add energy of motion or kinetic energy, until we give them a push. That push doesn't affect the mass energy within their topology. What it does is it adds energy to another field around them. A bit like when you push a boat that's been sitting very still in the lake, you give it a push, as it moves, it creates a wake. And the size of that wake is proportional to how fast it's going, and how fast it's going is proportional to how much force you applied to make it go at that speed. So you look at the energy of motion as what I call a KEM field, a chem field. That chem field has the kinetic energy and the magnetic moment in it. Because they're a field, and remembering back to how we define fields, it's obviously an equilateral scalar field, and that scalar field has squared numbers. If you accelerate an object from zero, you have to give it at least one quanta of energy that will make it move at, say, one. If you wanted to move at two, you'd have to give it four quanta of energy, because to get to two, remembering that the velocity is the square root of the energy, you have to give it four quanta. So you give it four quantas of force. The chem field now has four mass, energy, momenta, quanta, pushing it in a certain direction, saying go this way, and away it goes. What that then shows you is that acceleration, because the energy goes into an equilateral field, must always be applied using a boson of energy, an odd number. If the boat was already moving at one and you wanted it to go to two, you would have to add a boson of three, so that you had four, an energy of four, so it would move at two. Likewise, if you wanted to slow the boat down from two, you'd have to get rid of three quanta of energy as a boson, so that you only had one left, and the boat would slow down to a speed of one. So bosons, the odd numbers in physics, the odd geometries of mass energy, are in fact forms or acceleration and deceleration geometries. So if you hear the word, how much does it take to accelerate something, you can quickly work out the difference, the velocities, square them to get the energy, and just see what odd number, how many odd numbers are required to change from one squared number to the other. That's easily done for the mathematicians using Fermi's difference of two squares. And in fact, my fifth ebook, The Geometrics, where I cover the math, I show that acceleration and Fermi's theory, the difference of two squares, is just an equilateral geometry that you can apply to mass energies. And in fact, that very same geometry gives you fractions for numbers. If you take away any sequence of odd numbers out of a squared number, you have a fraction of the original number, and that applies directly to spectral lines, emission and absorption, and the photoelectric effect. So what we've covered so far in this is that as I developed the geometries by physically building them and manipulating them, I worked out that mass energies are always odds or even geometries, planar geometries, and that matter or fermions are always made up of tetrahedral topologies, which means that all matter must have 4n pi charges. And when you start looking closely at the plus, all the plus and minus charges that make up the topologies of the matter or the fermions, you quickly discover that the elementary charge is always a multiple of 12. Electrons have a negative 12. Protons are a positive 12 charge. Electrons, for example, are made up entirely of negative charges, negative mass energies, to make a net negative 12 topology. In the case of protons, we have 24 positive charged fascia and 12 negative. 24 minus 12 gives you plus 12, which is the exact opposite charge of the electron, even though it is a completely different topology. Electrons have 12 charge fascia, mass energy fascia. Protons have 36 charged fascia. Interestingly enough, the final piece of the puzzle, which proved that what I was doing was more than likely right and I hadn't gone insane, was that the other baryon to the proton was the neutron. When I looked at the number of positive and negative charges in the 36 charge topology of a neutron, there were 18 positive charges and 18 negative charges, leaving me with a net charge of zero, a neutral or neutral topology, a neutron. And again, going through all the particles, the partial charges, charge topologies of quarks, even though they have 12 charge fascia like an electron, came out to be plus or minus 4 or 8, which is 1/3 and 2/3 of the elementary charge of 12. So what that shows then is that the elementary charge, which is normally taken to be plus 1 or minus 1, is in fact plus 12 or minus 12. Yet another correction that had to take place in physics as I developed the theory. the important thing that really came out of it was now we could see that charge gives us shape. It lets us develop odd numbers of quanta to come together to form fields and what's the word I'm looking for? Fields, bosons. Bosons and fields and photons came together via odds and even numbers. And where we had three-dimensional shapes formed, the fermions, the particles, versus the fields, we had 4n pi. It was always 4n pi because they were always made up of tetrions. So an electron, which is 12 charged topologies, is actually three tetrions formed together. A quark has three tetrions forming it together. A baryon has nine tetrions forming it together to form its shape. There's a lot more discussion on the difference between charged geometries and topology, because some of those 36 charges in the baryons, for example, end up hidden inside the overall topology of the particle, a bit like walls inside a house. You might have 20 walls on the outside of the house, but it's made up of 36 walls inside if you count the ones that you can't see from the outside. So there's a lot of finessing that goes on in understanding the difference between planar geometries for mass energy, the charge that's brought about by their pluses and minuses, and how these plus and minus mass energies form particles or fermions via a physical 3D topology. And that's sort of what had to be nutted out over the first 12 months of developing tetrionic theory. Because without a clear understanding of mass and matter, energy and charge within space itself, you can't move on to the bigger subjects and the more detailed subjects of, like, what is electricity, or how do spectral lines form using these geometries, and what is gravity? Is it just something to do with matter, or do electromagnetic fields play some role? And you really need to differentiate between mass and matter in a very intuitive way. And I think tetrionics does that. I think it gives you the immediate understanding that if somebody says mass energy, it can be a field, it can be a charge, it can be a photon. It's a flat piece of paper for all intents and purposes. Whereas if they talk about matter particles, you immediately know that they have some topology, a shape, something that takes up space, has a volume, and that all these mass energy, charge mass energies that make up these topologies give us these physical properties that we take as elementary charges and things like that. But sadly, because we've developed all these terms without the geometry that we now possess with tetrionics, the terms have become mixed up, where mass and matter get swapped back and forth in the same sentences with the wrong meaning. Where people today, even at the Large Hadron Collider, if you ask them what a photon looks like, they'll draw you a little round ball. A proton is a bigger rounder ball. They can't explain what makes a certain object heavier than the other, apart from the Higgs field and the Higgs boson. Well, by now you should immediately, having said the word Higgs boson, have pictured up or conjured up a picture in your own mind of an equilateral geometry that somehow gives the property of inertial mass to matter. And your understandings of mass and matter should be better. So I should be, and I'm hopefully quietly confident here, that if I say that in the case of a proton with 20 charged faces on the outside of its topology has 20 Higgs bosons, I think you'll make the connection. Each fascia of a particle has mass energy, inertial mass energy. And it's these charged fascia, as they move through the vacuum energies of space, that resist energy being added to it. So the Higgs boson, as it's described currently by physicists, even to this very day, and possibly until they see my work and understand it, is described as being some little round ball that slows matter down, makes it harder to move through the vacuum energies of space. When in fact, it is nothing more than a charged, one of, say, 36 charged fascia in the case of a baryon, one of 12 charged fascia in the case of the electron. So it's actually incorrect to say the proton has a Higgs boson that causes it to slow down. It in fact has 36 charged fascia, 36 Higgs bosons that cause it to go slower, just the same as a box kite has a number of faces, and the more faces it has, the slower it goes in the breeze, the more resistance there is. That is all the Higgs boson and the Higgs mechanism is. The only reason to keep the name Higgs boson, the only differentiating feature of the Higgs boson from a boson that we've described previously, is that where normal bosons are odd numbers, Higgs bosons, being charged fascia, actually have squared numbers of quanta. They're the scalar, charged scalar energy fascia of all matter. They exist in fields, which is why I don't particularly like using the term, because it's just another term for a scalar energy field. But they exist in mass matter, in boson, in photons and electromagnetic fields, but they don't interact with matter to the same extent, because the piece of paper is cutting through the wind, through the air, is a better word, whereas in the case of a particle, it's side on, like the box kite, and that's giving it a resistance to its motion. The inertial component actually comes about because of all Planck quanta acting as inductive loops, but that's another story. But
yeah, but perhaps in what I've discussed, that's very so good far, to sort that out, because in a way that induced loop, basically what you're describing now is that the surface which is created, yeah, it is inertial because it seems to have a form of closure within it. So in a way,
it's a loop of energy that resists change.
By being a loop.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is it's an intersection between, it's a dimensional intersection, so to say, which explains why the confusion emerges around it.
That inertial loop of energy, the Planck quanta, the triangle itself of a quanta, with its north, with its magnetic dipole and its electric field, is nothing more, or can be modeled as, an inductor. When you put a current through it, it makes a north and a south pole. You then join the ends back together, and that energy will circulate endlessly around that loop through the inductor in exactly the same fashion as the triangles that I've drawn in tetrionics. But if you try to add energy or take energy away from that inductor, it will resist the change. Electrical engineers call inductors electrical mass because they behave exactly like inertial mass. That is the basis, electrically, of inertia. The geometry, the equilateral geometry of the EM Planck field, is what creates inertia. Now, you might have 1 by 10 to the 19 which is the actual number in most cases, of these Planck quanta in one charged fascia out of 36 that make up the proton. But when you go to move the proton, all those triangles of energy, all those little inductive loops, have to move through the medium, whether it's air or whether it's vacuum energy, makes no difference. As it tries to move through, what happens is all those little inductive loops resist any change of energy, and that creates the inertia that they're trying to describe as being part of the effect of the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson isn't what's giving it inertial resistance. It's the mass energy itself of the Planck quanta that gives the inertial resistance. The Higgs boson is just another add-on theoretical expansion to current theory, as it's poorly understood, to try and account for the property of inertia. It accounts for it along the way. It reintroduces the notion of an ether, which Einstein was at great pains to try and get rid of, along with the Michelson-Morley experiments. But it has to reintroduce the ether in order to explain via the Higgs mechanism how the Higgs boson works. But they're still picturing it as this super massive particle of matter that somehow magically resides in something many times smaller and many times lighter than what it is, for a whole number of errors that are made in the way that they do their experiments and do their calculations. Tetrionics gets rid of all of that and just says, build yourself a paper model of a proton and try to throw it through the air compared to a triangle of paper, or compared to a paper plane. The paper plane will slice through the air. It still has charged fascia. It still has inertial mass, but it has no matter. So the object, the proton with matter, has these fascia that angle up at different angles, and they act like little sails. It slows it down and affects it. And that's the mechanism that's truly at work. The Higgs boson can still keep the name. I prefer to call them charge for what they are. They're charged fascia. But we've just spent the last 2 years having Higgs boson and God particle thrown into our vocabulary. Mm-hmm. But that's the mechanism of the two. Bosons and photons, odds and evens, flat mass energies, geometries. Matter, topologies, and that's the difference. If you see topology, you know it's matter. It's got volume, and it has mass, but mass does not have a topology.
Calvin, it's really wonderful how you make the distinction between these levels and keep on referring to the way you discovered it for yourself, the paper models, and now basically sorting out something which is very difficult for people to understand because of the confusions which are implied in the models of physics. I had my initial inertial intuitive resistance against the whole theory of quantum physics because I realized that what I was being told didn't gel with what I had already discovered, the four-dimensional logic, in which basically you see that everything needs to turn inside out in a very simple dynamics, which tetrionics shows in the same way. What I was lacking at that time was precisely that logical discernment between the different dimensions which are involved. And I would like to suggest that we end this recording section so that we can then come back, if you like, to talk about the other levels of tetrionic atoms and the tetrionic materials, organic and inorganic. Because in the first section you have explained that, okay, we need to understand the difference in the nature of the dimensions. Pointed lines, triangles which have a direction, and tetrahedrons, which basically set aside a reserved section of space. And then in the second part, you showed how important it is to make that distinction between the flat triangles and the three-dimensional tetrahedra, because of the whole difference of the interplay in those electromagnetic fields. And you've already coupled that to the difference between bosons, which are basically in one direction, the photons, which are basically in two directions, and then the fermions, which basically have the three directions. It would be really nice if you could then continue with a quick run through on the atoms, which we have already discussed separately, but just to bring that in perspective here, because now we see that the building blocks, as you call it, then they're just like Lego elements, the play kit units, which you can then use to create the atoms. And as you have described that already separately, after a quick run through on that, it would be nice to see then how that works for the molecules. As in science, there is this distinction between the organic and the inorganic molecules, or the molecules with a connection to life, or the molecules without a connection to life. In other words, the molecules in connection to life is those where the electron flow through the molecules is really important, as we have in our body, where our consciousness is that electromagnetic software field for which the body is the conduit, the motherboard.
Yeah.
And I would be really interested to hear how, for you, that difference between organic and inorganic probably resolves in tetrionics. So can I just come back to you, hang up first? Come back?
By all means, Otto.
Thank you.